But the Bible details the lives of real people, many great champions of faith and servants of God, but we should also appreciate its authenticity. It does not hide or shy away from the mistakes that these same people made throughout their lives. Or, you know, the Bible doesn't paint the world in a picture or a perspective of, oh, you know, everything's perfect and there's a force field around us if we're servants of Christ. But rather, it highlights the reality of life and shows how they were able to overcome them and champion life. So tonight, I'd like to look at the book of Ecclesiastes. Tucked away in the Old Testament may not be your first thought of something to study. But tonight, I would like to highlight and overview some of the reasons I think you should. It's helped me tremendously in my life lately. Maybe you're stuck in your personal study and you're looking for something to help you through everyday life. We often look to the sources of the world for help with these things instead of the Bible. And more than any other book in the Bible, by my estimation, Ecclesiastes simply paints a picture of the real world. So let's start out with who's the author, who is he writing to. Ecclesiastes in Greek means the speaker to the assembly, or literally the church. And gathered from verse 1 and verse 12 of chapter 1, we can conclude that the speaker is Solomon, son of King David, the man after God's own heart. But for this book, Solomon speaks not as a king to his lowly subjects that are beneath him, but as one of us, sharing his wisdom and experience on our level. Why should we listen to Solomon? Because of his faithfulness early on in his life, God appeared to Solomon and told him to ask for anything, and he would be given it. Above all things, Solomon chose wisdom. How many of us, you know, I don't remember exactly how old Solomon was at the time, but as a young man, and God comes to you and asks you for, you know, you can have anything in the world. I will grant it to you because you are my faithful servant. How many of us would quickly choose something physical or something that pops in our mind or something that we've really been wanting for a long time? But Solomon chose wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 9, he said, "So give your servant a receptive heart to judge your people and discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?" Now it pleased the Lord that Solomon had requested this, so God said to him, "Because you have requested this and did not ask for long life or riches for yourself or the death of your enemies, but you asked discernment for yourself to administer justice, I will therefore do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has never been anyone like you before and never will be again." And in 1 Kings 4, God gave Solomon wisdom, very great insight and understanding as vast as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East, greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone, wiser than those people. His reputation extended to all the surrounding nations. Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. He spoke about trees from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop growing out of the wall. He also spoke about animals, birds, reptiles, and fish. A miscellany of all people sent by every king on earth who had heard of his wisdom came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. There was no one before or after Solomon that was as wise as him, and that is divine wisdom from God himself. He was wiser than all of the other famous thinkers of his day and age, knowledgeable about all things spiritual and worldly, so much so that people came from far and wide just to sit at his feet and listen to what he had to say. Now, he may have now been dead for thousands of years, but how lucky are we to have just some of his thoughts in writing at our disposal. In this book and a few others in the Old Testament, getting a little taste of that divine wisdom. As we begin to overview, I'd actually like to start at the very end of the book, which doesn't make a lot of sense, as we try to figure out what it's all about. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13, as the book ends, says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." Solomon is about to embark on a great journey of observation about so many aspects of life that it's hard to count. But as he mentions and as we study all these things, remember where he ends up and where we should end up when we study it. So, back to the beginning. I think at some point in time, every person questions their purpose in this life. Everyone seeks the meaning of life and wants to know why he or she is here. Further, we try to do things in life that give us fulfillment and satisfaction. Many times we think we cannot find satisfaction because we don't have enough resources. For example, we think, if I just had more money, I'd be able to do more things in life, which would make us happier, and we would be so fulfilled and happy. If only we had more knowledge, if we were smarter, we'd be more satisfied with life. You know, I could one-up that person because I'm smarter than them. If we only had more power and control, then we would be content with this life. In essence, our belief is the old saying, the grass is greener on the other side. But we have no way of experiencing the other side. Comparison is the thief of joy. All these things, too, we may think in respect to other people. If I just had what they had, whether it be in looks or money or whatever, life would be better. But I just don't have enough to get to where the grass is greener. So we find our lives to be frustrating, unrewarding, and unsatisfying. So we strive harder in life to get to the greener grass, but often come up short. The book of Ecclesiastes is so interesting because we are presented with a person who was able to experience the greener grass. Not only was this person able to find the greener grass, but he wrote a whole journal recording his experience in that greener grass. As a result of Solomon asking God for wisdom instead of something material, in addition, God blessed Solomon with material blessings greater than any other who had lived before him or after him. And you can read on in these chapters that describe his immense wealth of gold and livestock and perfumes and all the fancy food he ate. And he had 700 wives. I find it hard enough to find one. The point is that Solomon did have it all. He is the perfect person to read reflections about his life. Solomon is going to tell us about all the things he tried in life and tell us what he found. But before going into the details, Solomon begins by giving us a summary of what he found. What do you think he would say about all these things? What do you think he would say being as rich as he was, being as wise as he was, being as powerful as he was, and pursuing and indulging in every possible pleasure? I believe that we would think Solomon would say, you know, I found happiness, I found joy, I found contentment, satisfaction, and peace. But notice the words that he declares as a summary of what he found in all these pursuits. Everything is futile. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility, everything is futile. And I'm going to quote a little bit from the Christian Standard Bible because it uses a pretty literal translation of the Hebrew words here. And futile is a good word because it means pointless and empty and meaningless. And yeah, go ahead, Paul. Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. And Ecclesiastes, it covers all of that from this life to the next life and everything in between. You know, there's not much in between, but you get the point. So he says, I'm going to bring up some more things that Paul just talked about in a minute. You know, so Solomon tells us it was pointless and it was empty, his pursuit of the things in this life. It was not what he thought it would be. It was not, and it is not what we think it'll be. The teacher did not find satisfaction and lasting pleasure in these things. Everything was fleeting, empty, pointless, and senseless. This is not at all what we expected him to say about the greener grass. You know, how could this be? This accumulation of power, wealth, and wisdom, how could that be futile? And a couple, you know, points is that he's trying to make is the lure of something better tomorrow robs us of the joys offered today. The good life, the one that truly satisfies, exists only when we stop wanting a better one. We always have heard people deny this idea that grass is greener, but we need to believe it. The grass is not greener on the other side. The teacher has been there, and he has found emptiness. It's a powerful warning to us today who seem to always want more and more and not be content with what we have and where we are now. you know, savor what is and rather than longing for what might be. And, you know, we can plunge ourselves into filling the voids in our lives with pleasures and wealth and power and knowledge, but at every turn, you won't find what you're looking for. And we don't want to believe it. We want to believe that we want to believe there to be more to life. But take it from a person who tried it. So Solomon's going to begin to fixate on the futility of some specific things, describing them often as striving after the wind. I don't know if you've ever tried to grab the wind before. It doesn't go very well, whether with your fingers or a net or a mouse trap. It doesn't really go well. So we start with the futility of wisdom. Well, Solomon was wise, but so what does he mean? Solomon decides to amass wisdom so much more than everyone else, and he applied his mind to thoroughly understand wisdom and knowledge, found that putting one's life purpose in increasing one's knowledge to be chasing after the wind. Well, why? In verse 18 of chapter 1, he says, "For with much wisdom is much sorrow, as knowledge increases, grief increases." More knowledge and wisdom sometimes only increases frustration, heartache, and grief. You know, we often say, ignorance is bliss, and what you don't know won't hurt you. And that's frustrating because sometimes you know what to do, you know what's right, but no one else pursues this wise path. And there's great frustration in knowing what people ought to do, but they choose not to do it. They don't listen to, you know, wise counsel. And knowledge is not fulfilling. Many times knowing things causes more pain. You know, I don't really ever watch the news. You know, think about everything that's on the news. It's all bad. You know, they'll tell you 20 straight stories about murder and violence and all these terrible things that happen. And then they'll give you one story about a puppy being adopted. And you're supposed to, that's all the intake that you get from the world. And it paints a picture of the world being a worse place than it is sometimes. And it's also futile because we will never find all the answers in our search and our quest for knowledge and wherever we look for it. You know, they're not answers to all the questions that we have in this life outside of the Word of God. The world does not contain answers, and it forces us to rely on God for everything that we can't understand, for that we can't, you know, describe and comprehend. We have God. We have God to rely on, and He's not going to do us wrong. And great wisdom doesn't fix life's problems. That's going to be a recurring theme of all these things. They don't fix life's problems. You know, what's wrong cannot be straightened. And it just leads to pain and frustration. So, moving on. If anyone, you know, questions, comments, go ahead and stop me. I'm going to talk as fast as I possibly can. So, next he gets into the futility of self-indulgence. Solomon tries to find satisfaction in the pleasures of this world. When he talks about laughter in these verses, he's not talking about just laughing, giggling. He's talking about partying. Solomon's going to try the party scene. And, you know, as someone as rich and powerful and as Solomon was, you can imagine the extravagant parties that he was able to have and indulge himself in. And, you know, he gave himself fully into this lifestyle. And he says, you know, my mind is still guiding me with wisdom. And so he was rationally testing controlled indulgences that were allowed of him in that day. And he thought, well, this is the answer. I'm just going to party it up. But Solomon found this to be madness and that it accomplished nothing. Well, why was there no value? You know, drinking does not take away the pain, and that's a real problem in the society that we have today. So many people think that they can forget their problems and wash away their sorrows in drinking, but it does not. The pain remains and your problems remain when you come out the other side. These things can't kill the pain. If we have problems in life, you have to address those problems. You have to fix those problems because they're going to continue to exist, no matter how sober you are or not. Further, Solomon points out that these things are a waste of time. When you get done out of your high of this party, of this lifestyle, you haven't accomplished anything. Your life's not any better. Nothing has been done. And we're going to talk more later about making the best use of our time. Wealth and women. I thought about just making that the title of this lesson. Solomon then plunges into the rest of life's pleasures. He gets all this silver and gold. In fact, Solomon says, All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure. Again, he says, my wisdom also remained with me. So Solomon, you know, we know he had 700 wives, 300 concubines, and this is, you know, the greatest lure of the American society. You know, we glorify the wealthy person who can have any man or woman that they want. But Solomon says, you know, I've been there. There was no satisfaction or lasting happiness here. He points out that there was pleasure in these things. He did enjoy them for a while, but it was still futility and chasing after the wind. There was nothing to be gained from that kind of living. We think more money and more stuff and will bring us happiness, but it doesn't. Futility in being a workaholic. Solomon concludes by pointing out that overworking is futile for a number of reasons. You know, again, talking about society, we live in a society that glorifies the workaholic. Men are made to believe that there's something wrong with them if you only work 40 hours a week. And women are made to believe that there's something wrong with them if they don't have a secular job along with caring for their children. But Solomon's going to tell you why plunging yourself entirely into your work is foolish. All our gain from our work is left to another who has not worked and may be a fool. You cannot keep what is gained from working. So why do you try so hard to accumulate wealth when you can't take it with you? You're still going to die. All you're doing is giving that wealth to someone who did not work for it and who may simply be foolish with all of your hard work. And as I say that, I see my dad writing me out of the will in the back. It's weird that he brought that tonight, but overworking brings grief and a lack of rest. When you read verse 23 and see if this sounds like something you're experiencing. For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. We have to work, and we do often find careers that we are passionate about and bring us a lot of joy. But we have to remember, it's work. We get paid to do it. You know, the rest of that statement, even at night, the mind does not rest. We become consumed with work. We cannot even rest because we are so focused upon what's going to happen the next day at our job. We're so focused on these things that we can't take the time to enjoy life. I know people like this, that at work, that, you know, they just can't turn things off when they go home and they just worry all night long and they don't sleep. And the best thing about problems sometimes is there'll still be problems tomorrow. It's okay sometimes, just shut it down today, try again tomorrow, and maybe you'll have better luck. You know, don't let it take away from your rest and your happiness. And then Solomon gives important counsel. Enjoy the fruit of your labor. Do not overwork. Work enough to take care of what you need, that you can enjoy life and enjoy your earnings. We work so much that we cannot even enjoy the reason we work, the earnings. No, we think we must have more. Solomon says that we need to do enough to be able to enjoy life. Understand that life does not consist of work. Again, we have to work, but it's not our purpose for existence. And in conclusion, you know, all these things we're talking about, you know, these things may seem bleak and dreary to us. Well, you know, Solomon's going through all these things and, well, is everything bad? But here is Solomon's first important realization. Life cannot be enjoyed apart from God. All the things we talked about are good things within themselves. Hard work, having fun, wives. But without God, they mean nothing. With God, you can have wisdom, knowledge, and joy. You can have a good life when you are pleasing to God. You can enjoy life and appreciate the fruit of your labor. But for those who do not have God, for those who are wicked, life is simple monotony. It's working and accumulating wealth for no purpose at all, and then you die. So apart from God, life is futile. Wisdoms, pleasures, wealth, and work have no value without Him. Life simply becomes the grind. And when you look at our lives, as our lives became a grind, a monotonous chore for us, we need to examine our relationship with God and understand that satisfaction is not in this life, it is with the Lord. So let's talk about time, a time for everything. There's no way I'm going to get through all this. So let's play pretend. Let's say that someone calls you and says, an anonymous donor that loves you very much is going to give you 86,400 pennies every morning in your bank account for the rest of your life, for 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. They're going to give you that many pennies. That's $864. But there's one catch. you have to spend all that money the same day. You can't take any money that you get one day and carry it over to the next. And, you know, you're excited and you thank him and hang up and, you know, you start writing things down with a pencil and you say, well, $864 times 7, that's $6,000 a week. Times 52, that's $315,000 a year. And then you think, $350,000 a year? I'm like, I can save that money for a year and I can buy a new house. Well, you missed the point. You don't get that much cumulative. You get that every day. And you can't, you have to be diligent to spend that money every day. So let's stop playing pretend and let's play real life. Every morning, someone who loves you very much deposits into your bank 86,400 seconds of time, which represents 1,440 minutes, which of course is a 24-hour day. Now you must remember the same stipulation applies. God gives you this amount of time to use each day. Nothing is ever carried over on credit to the next day. There's no such thing as a 26-hour day, as much as we want one sometimes. And there's no such thing as a 20-hour day. If the day really stinks, you can't just say, this one's done, I want the next one. It's not how it works. From today's dawn until tomorrow's dawn, you have a precisely determined amount of time. As someone, and you know, life is like a coin. You can spend it any way you want to. You can only spend it once. And we all, each day, have the same amount of time allotted to us. It does not matter if you're dirt poor or have great wealth, if you're young or you're old, you have the same amount of time each day. Time is the easiest thing wasted, yet is the one thing we often say we don't have enough of. When we are on, I know I've made this point before, but when we're on our deathbeds, many, all of us, many, many years from now, you know, are you going to say, I wish I just had a little more money? Or I wish I would have made that career move 35 years ago. Or I wish, I know, I really regret not doing this at my job 40 years ago. No, you're not going to say that on your deathbed. You're going to say, I just wish I had a little more time. So a little more time to spend with my family, my loved ones, and enjoy the things in this life. I don't think I got enough out of it. Well, we need to start taking that to heart today. And, you know, Ephesians 5, verse 15 says, look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. So there is a time for everything. The point the wise writer makes is that there is a time and place for every single thing in life. The circumstances of life are constantly changing, and there is need for us to be ready for the changing occasions. Nothing in life stays in its current state. There's a time to give birth, and there's a time for death. Life situations change. Consider looking outside at the fall, and you see, you know, all the leaves changing, and the crops being harvested, and things like that. Well, then they have to be planted again in the spring, and it's a constant cycle. Things constantly change. You know, Jake, when, you put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into your house when you built it. I know that. But there's a non-zero chance that someday that my grandchild tears your house down. We put so much time and we think about buildings and houses and things like that and how much, you know, time we put into them and how much memories, and they're filled with so much. You think about an old football stadium that, you know, has seen, you know, so many great athletic feats and all these things and all these memories and is cherished, and one day it gets tore down. One day it gets destroyed. And, you know, it's the teacher is asking us to look around and consider life, and, you know, and crops and buildings are good examples of that. Everything has its time. There is a season for everything, and nothing remains permanent. This concept is now applied to the life of humans. There's a time for sadness. There's a time for laughter. If you're having a difficult time in life, he pretty much promises you, understand that life will not always be this way. There are times of great difficulty, but it will not always be this way. If you're enjoying happiness, if you're enjoying laughter, things are going great, enjoy it, because life will not always be like this. You know, shout out Darius Rucker. Won't be like this for long. I'm, you know, kind of an emotional guy, but that song makes me cry every time. There are times of enjoyment, but know that life is not full of only good times. Life is always changing. There's a time for everything. Think about how quickly life circumstances can change, how fast your world can be turned upside down with the health diagnosis of ourselves or our family members. Or, you know, you've finally been given your big break or chance in your career. There's a time for embrace and there's a time not to embrace. There's a time to keep things, there's a time to throw them away. Life is a vapor. Life is transitory. There is a time to keep silent, there's a time to speak. There's a time for love and a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Life is constantly changing. We have to be ready for this change. And so, some takeaways. We cannot assume that life will be as it is now. We have to assume, or we have the tendency to assume, that things will always be this way, good or bad. And it leads to an obvious conclusion. Appreciate what you have now. It may not be this way tomorrow. One day, great happiness. The next day, crushing news. Such is the nature of the world. The short time given to you will have many ups and downs. In fact, in verse 11, he seems to be teaching that this is the way that God set the world into motion. Don't expect things to be different. God has made everything appropriate in its time. And then in verse 11, he makes a profound statement mentioning eternity in our hearts. And he says he has also put eternity in their hearts. Despite the knowledge of the brief nature of life and the ever-changing nature of our circumstances, we have within us an innate feeling that there is something more to life. God has placed that innate feeling within us. You know, like I mentioned earlier, everyone ponders the meaning of life. Everyone considers life after death. Nearly everyone thinks that there's got to be something more that happens when we die. Now, you know, many people debate what happens when we die. But it seems that everyone has that sense that there is more to life than this. Therefore, humans set themselves to the task of finding out what more there is to life. You know, earlier we talked about we're each given equal time. You cannot save today's and use it tomorrow. When you put that together with the ever-changing nature of life and eternity in our hearts, the conclusion is drawn that we need to use our time to plan for our future. All of us know that there is something more to life, yet we only have a set amount of time, which throws us on life's roller coaster. So what are we doing to prepare for, you know, the eternity that lies ahead? There's no slowing down the inevitable. Time has begun for each of us, but our time has not yet ended. Verses 12 and 13, the teacher returns to a theme of this book, point we've mentioned already. Enjoy the fruit of your labor. Enjoy life. But there's a little more added to that. It says, you have time today. Enjoy the time you have today. Circumstances will change. Enjoy the moments you have now. It is not necessarily that life will be any better or worse tomorrow. We just don't know. But it could be different. You know, there's times when you're single in life and you have no responsibilities and you're living carefree. There's a time when you are married and for the first time and you get to, you know, enjoy that quality time with your spouse and build a relationship. And then you have children and you get to enjoy them so much when they're little and they're completely dependent on you for everything. And then there's a time when children are no longer dependent. They're completely independent. You see that life keeps changing. We must enjoy every little moment because of this change, and we will have something to appreciate. Do we see life as a gift of God? Do we see the activities of life as a season to enjoy? Well, Solomon says we should. And our time is fleeting, but God's is permanent. This, you know, fragile nature of life points us to God. This seems to be the final conclusion of this section. The futility of this world makes us want eternity. Even though there is life to enjoy here and now, the lack of lasting satisfaction points us to God, whose actions are not futile and whose work lasts forever. Nothing in life is permanent and nothing in life is perfect, but God is perfect and permanent. Our futility should lead us to God's perfection. In the final verses of chapter 3, he says, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. And all go to one place, all from dust, and all to dust return. So again, you know, life is constantly changing. All of us have time now, need to make the best use of our time, and don't forget to enjoy life, maximizing the time allotted to you. And chapter, Ms. Han? Yeah, Jeannie?
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you're right, and I think that's what Solomon's encouraging is to, you know, stop at the different moments in your life, wherever you may be, and just soak it all in, wherever you are in life. Just stop for a second, be content, look at the sunset, look at nature, look at a beautiful animal, and soak it all in, and enjoy it, and take little things away, and grow, and again, relate those things back to God, and the fragile nature of our lives, and the eternity that he offers. Yeah, Matt. Yeah, that's a really good point, how that changes the end of that statement. Yeah, to live is Christ and to die is gain. If you live for anything else, you can't say to die is gain anymore. You know, that you get to lose that. That's a good point, Matt. I'm gonna start to bounce around here. Got only 9 more chapters to go in 5 minutes. Let's do labor or lazy, a proper balance. So we've already talked about don't be a workaholic, you know, and then he points out in verse 4 that sometimes we tend to overwork because we're envy of our neighbor. And, you know, our excessive work sometimes comes with rivalry. We want to keep up with the Joneses, no pun intended. We work harder because we see other people with things that we want. We see their success, we want to have the same success or more. No one is happy for someone else's success. Like, I can never understand that. When something good happens to someone and immediately someone tries to tear it down because their life is not going the same way. You know, if there's something wrong in their life and they like to pull other people down with them. I don't understand it. We see people's success and we want the same or more. We want to outdo our neighbor, not just keep up with them. We're not happy for them. And he says such thinking is foolish and chasing after the wind. The reason is because you can never stay ahead. There's always going to be someone that has more money than you. There's always going to be someone that has a bigger house than you, a nicer car than you. There's always going to be something that has more than you. And if you focus on that every day of your life, you're not going to ever find the satisfaction that you're looking for. And then he makes the point, are we to quit working because being a workaholic is wrong? No. He says that's foolish. Says laziness brings about poverty, and then makes the point that life is about good balance. Verse 6, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. The good life is about balance. It is better to have one hand full of quietness than two hands full of toil and chasing after the wind. Why overwork? Because two handfuls of toil will not bring lasting satisfaction. And by implication, two handfuls of quietness is not the answer to satisfaction either. One hand working, one hand quiet, that's the balanced life. Work what you need and enjoy the fruit of your labor. Stop looking at what others have and enjoy what you have. And then he's just really picking on us overworkers here. Excessive work leads to being alone. He says in verse 7 and 8, again, I saw futility under the sun. There is a person without a companion, without even a son or brother. Yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is futile and a miserable task. This is a person who works and works. There's no end to all their struggle. Even with all he does, he's not content. And this person is alone. He doesn't have a companion. He doesn't have family. He has no friends. It's hard to be friends with a workaholic because they never have any time for you. You can't spend time together. That person's always working. You'll end up with no friends and no family. The most foolish decision that people make is believing that they'll overwork now so that they can spend time with their family later. Or they'll overwork now and then I'll get my relationship with God right later. Is a mistake that so many people make. And they prioritize their career over everything else in their life. The problem is that family won't be there later. And your desire to serve God probably won't be there later. And he mentions the worst part is, you know, this workaholic, they never stop and ask, why are they doing this? Your family doesn't need all that money. They just want time with you. You will have friends when you're available to spend time with others. There's no end to your struggles and toil, and you have nothing to show for it. Better to have companions. The teacher concludes by pointing out that people are better than wealth. There's no joy in living alone. Solomon says to pity the person who falls down but has no one to lift them up. Two are better than one. We want to think that the good life is being self-sufficient. And to some extent, that's true. We are all responsible for our own souls, and we have to find our own worth and purpose and before we can do a lot of other things. But the extreme is simply another lie fed to us by the world. Self-sufficiency is not the ultimate goal. It is better to have companions, friends, and family and be dependent on them. Life is better with more people. Don't isolate yourself. Remember the parable of the rich fool. It's going real fast now. All right. I'll wrap it up there.